Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Joseph Ellis, who reads from and discusses his new book, His Excellency, George Washington, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Linda Fairstein, Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to both welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. Tonight's guest has won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Founding Brothers and the National Book Award for American Sphinx. We are delighted that he is with us tonight to present His Excellency George Washington. With this book, yet another best-selling title by this premier historian of the Revolutionary Era, with this book, Dr. Joseph Ellis should win a prize simply for bringing this remote, iconic figure out from behind his statue and into our hearts with this human portrait of the great American patriarch. There is no question that we all have strong impressions of our first president. His image graces our dollar, his face etched upon great stone at Rushmore, his wooden dentures fascinating us to no end. And if you grew up on the East Coast, you were told that George Washington slept here, that he slept there. But really, we know the legend. We do not know the man. He was a great distant figure. Joseph Ellis changes all that with this highly acclaimed portrait. And again, we are very glad to welcome this renowned historian to the Tattered Cover. Please give a warm welcome to Joseph Ellis.
Thank you. I come to you via Seattle and San Francisco, and in Seattle, after delivering, I'm sure, what was a brilliant lecture, I came back to the hotel room and ran square into a glass coffee table, and I sprained my ankle, and I had to get, like, you know, in a wheelchair through airports and stuff like that, and so I'm injured, and I might have to sit down at some point in time. If I do, nah, I'm okay. Let's do it as long as we can. Anyway, I'm going to talk tonight, and I'm not going to lecture. I don't have a text. I have some thoughts. I've thought about what I want to say, but it is my assumption that what you want is a talk rather than a lecture. Am I correct? There might be some imprecision as a result of that, but I think the energy is better that way. What I'd like to do is talk for 30 or 35 minutes and then leave at least 30 minutes for questions. I saw today on the news on CNN that George Bush was at Kansas State, and for the first time it was an audience that wasn't filtered, and he was given lots of credit for responding candidly and improvisationally. I'm ready to do the same thing. And I'm a teacher from Mount Holyoke. Is anybody from Mount Holyoke here? Nobody from Mount Holyoke. Okay. Worcester. Amherst. Amherst College? God bless you. I have a house in Amherst, and I'm on a hill. It looks down on Amherst College, and there's nothing I've always wanted to do more than look down on Amherst College. I teach courses there periodically too. It's a great liberal arts college. Perhaps the best, as a matter of fact. I'm going to talk about Washington and the founders. But the real truth is here that we're here to sell books. And at this bookstore and throughout the land, I have a 15-year-old son, my third child and last and youngest child. The other two are just out of the nest. And Alexander sometimes does his homework at my desk and writes notes to me on the blotter. And when I haven't spent the day working, he leaves a note that says, "Dad, get going. I need to go to a good college." So if you purchase this book, you will be contributing to the Alexander Ellis Educational Fund, and it's worth it. He's a good boy. I want to start with a question. It's about the founders in general. I call it my, what's the name of that town in is it Pennsylvania? Yeah. The town in Pennsylvania that has the population, the same population of Virginia in 1776. It'll come to me in a sec. If we went to that town now, could we find the rough equivalent, in modern terms, of George Washington, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Mason, John Marshall? Now, you got to believe they're there. The latent ability of people is not going to change. There wasn't something special in the water back then. But we'll never find them. They won't come forward for public service. I'll tell you a story. I'd written a book called Founding Brothers, which came out at the same time as the 2000 presidential election. And I was on the book tour at the same time as the Florida imbroglio. And people wanted to know how in heaven's name we came up with this thing called the Electoral College, which is a weird contraption. But they also said many times, how come in 2000 we have to choose between Gore and Bush, sometimes said Gush and Boer, whereas in 1800, 200 years ago, we got to choose between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson? Now that's a mischievous question, and the answer, you know, is really that, well, you know, Mark Twain said it best when he went to the Holy Land. He wrote a book called Innocents Abroad, went to the Holy Land and said, "Christ been here once, will never come again," which was certainly correct. But I developed a mischievous answer, and I said, well, you know, Adams's grandson, great-grandson, Henry Adams, writing under the Grant administration, said, if you look at the history of the American presidency panoramically, you've got to believe that Darwin got it exactly backwards. Again, that's not fair, but I'm afraid there's some truth in that. But I come, you know, today to talk about Washington as the foundingest father of them all and try to say a few things about the founders as well as Washington himself in the hope that it might interest you. There has been a surge in the interest of the founders over the last decade or so. I'm a major beneficiary of that surge, and therefore I don't wish to analyze it too much. But I do think it has something to do with our own sense that the political culture of the United States in the early 21st century is not calling the best people to public service, and that once upon a time, that wasn't true. And that Alfred Lord Whitehead was probably right, the great British philosopher and essayist, when he said that there are only two occasions in world history that he knew of when the political elite of an emerging nation behaved about as well as one could ever possibly imagine. One was Rome under Caesar Augustus, and the other was the United States under this group called the Founders. I've written this book called His Excellency. It's about Washington. I began it with a question, a clear question, and a conviction. The question was this. Based on reading the papers of the other founders, and I've spent 30 years doing this, it seemed to me pretty clear that Benjamin Franklin was wiser than Washington, though that's an arguable point, depending on how you define wisdom. Thomas Jefferson was clearly more intellectually sophisticated. John Adams was better read and a more honest man. James Madison was more politically astute. Alexander Hamilton was more brilliant. If you gave the LSATs to all the founders, Hamilton would have gotten the highest score. And yet each of them, and all of them together, acknowledged that Washington was their superior. Now, why was that? What did he have? What did he carry with him? Adams said it was his size. Adams says in his old age, writing from Quincy, the reason we always selected Washington to lead us was that he was always the tallest man in the room. When he died, they measured his body and weighed it. He was 6'3 and a half and 202 pounds. This at a time when the height of the average American or Briton male was 5'6. So he was a head taller than everybody else. But obviously, that answer, while physically important, give the whole answer. Now, you have to read the book to get the whole answer. That means you have to buy the book, too. The conviction was this. Washington is the most famous hero in American history about whom most Americans, including most well-read and educated Americans, know almost nothing. And what they know is almost always wrong. He chopped down a cherry tree and could not tell a lie, a total fabrication. Parson Weems wrote that the year after he died. They had wooden teeth. He didn't have wooden teeth, ever. He had three or four different sets of dentures made of ivory bone and all this other stuff. And let me tell you another little story here. We're trying to develop the notion here that all these guys were great, but they were flawed. When Washington retired from, when he made his first retirement after the war, 1783, and went back to sit under his vine and fig tree at Mount Vernon, all kinds of visitors came to him as kind of pilgrimage to Mount Vernon. And one of them was this dentist, this French dentist named David Mayeur. Mayeur claimed to be an expert in a new technique called implants. Anybody had any implants? Now, you can imagine the state of dental science back then. But he said, I can replace all your teeth with these implants. And Washington said, okay. Question. Where did he get the teeth? Yes. You got it. Slaves. He paid them. It was a tradition in medieval Europe where peasants would often sell their teeth for money, in the same way that alcoholics sell their blood now. So when he was president, he had some teeth in his head that were slave teeth. And I got to tell you, when he died, you know, before he died, there were 319 slaves at Mount Vernon. And I got to tell you, he didn't write the farewell address. Alexander Hamilton wrote the farewell address. So I'm going to tell you stuff that doesn't fit the mythology. Nevertheless, I'm going to hope you conclude, as I did after spending 5 years with him, that he's the greatest leader in American history. Part of the problem is us, and part of the problem is him. Us. We don't want to know the truth. We want our heroes to be pure. If you think about it, you know, the heroes of European history, the founders of nations, are all fictional characters. Aeneas, Romulus and Remus, King Arthur, El Cid. Our heroes are real people, like us, flawed. God knows I'm flawed. I suspect you are too. We want to think of him in mythological ways, and the kind of evidence I've just given you makes that more difficult. Part of the problem is in him. He's an extremely aloof person. He wrote over 1,000 letters to his wife, and she burned them all after he died. So we've got, like, Abigail and John wrote 1,735 letters, which really reveal their marriage and their relationship. And nothing, there's three of their letters that have, of the Washington letters that have survived. He didn't want us to know about his personal life. And at a certain point in his life, after the war especially, everything he wrote was written with an eye towards posterity. Like, he knew we would be sitting in Denver. And so it's a kind of theatrical performance. And the monument and the man become almost indistinguishable. It's a famous story, apocryphal, I suspect, but at the Constitutional Convention, which he chaired, Alexander Hamilton said to another representative, Gouverneur Morris, who's a wonderful guy, a peg-legged guy, who's actually the torso model for Washington and the statue that the Virginia Historical Society now, done by Houdon, because they couldn't do it. He's the same size as Washington. And Hamilton says to Morris, I dare you to go up to Washington, put your hand on his shoulder and say, how you doing, George? So Morris goes up and does it. And Washington lifts his hand off of his shoulder and looks at him. There is space you don't go into with Washington. His diaries, he kept a long diary. It's all about the weather. Adams' diary is about introspection, about sin, about his own vanities, about his foibles. Tells you all kinds of wonderful stuff. When Washington talks about which way the wind is blowing, he's not being metaphorical. Last day of his public career, when he's retiring from the presidency, March 6th, 1797, what does he think? He spent all this time, public service, he's finally retiring back to Mount Vernon for the second time. What does he think? What does it say? March 6th, 1797, a day like all days, temperature 41 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, is that what he was really thinking? No. But that's what he's going to tell you. So he presents a real problem for a biographer like me who's interested in some sort of psychological insight. In some sense, he raises a problem, too, that's part of the founder's problem, this electromagnetic field that I talked about earlier. Let me tell you one story, really. Just one. I'd written this book on Jefferson, and I was doing a book tour, and I was in Richmond. And my book on Jefferson is somewhat critical of Jefferson as a somewhat duplicitous character. And this was all before the DNA evidence on Sally Hemings, by the way. And it wasn't a slam dunk, but it was critical. And this woman, an elderly woman, but very well coiffed and sartorially splendid, got up at the end, and she said, and I won't try to completely replicate the Richmond accent, which is highly distinctive. And she said, Professor Ellis, everything you said is wrong. And I know it's wrong, because Mr. Jefferson appeared to me in my bedroom last night. And he told me you were going to tell these lies about him. And then the great line, Mr. Ellis, you are a mere pigeon on the great statue of Thomas Jefferson. Now, at that moment, my response was, abba-dabba-dabba-dabba. Thank you very much. Next question. But she came up and she gave me her card, and she subsequently wrote me a letter with a poem to me about the clay feet of Joseph Ellis or something like that. It said her name and then poet. So I wrote her back about 2 months later, now this was the response I wish I had the wherewithal to have come up with at the moment. I said, "Madam, it's not really important whether or not you regard me as a pigeon. It's very important that you not regard Thomas Jefferson as a statue." I think we do think of them as a statue. I think we do think of them as icons. And Washington is the supreme example. He's on the dollar bill, the quarter, Mount Rushmore, the mall. Anybody been to the Washington Monument? What words are on the Washington Monument? There aren't any. The words on the Jefferson Memorial and on the Lincoln Memorial, "We hold these truths 87. There's no words. The only words are the graffiti written on the staircase by the tourists in the interior. So he's kind of, you know, aloof. I call him the man in the moon. It's like he's up there. We know he's up there. We don't, and different people can see different configurations and patterns in his visage. But he's not really down here with us. Jefferson is like Jesus. He's come back to earth. Washington is like God. He's way up there still. Bringing him back to earth is a challenge. The pattern that afflicts Washington and the founders in general, you could talk about this in historiographic terms and be very, very scholarly sophisticated. But let me ask you a question. How many out there are parents, have children? Okay. Tell me if you understand this. I have three boys. Two are out of the nest, one remains. Up to a certain point in their lives, our children think we are God or goddess. We are the source of all their, you know, we control everything. They cross some metabolic, psychiatric, emotional line, 10, 11, 12, varies. And previous to that line, we can do no wrong. Upre that line, we can do no right. It changes later, doesn't it? Thank you. I need to hear that. 35. Well, that's where you are being very, very prophetic as to what I want to try to argue here. The historiography of the founders is a direct expression of that same swoonish swing. Icons, heroes, myths, perfect, other side, deadest, whitest males in American history. The authors of racism, classism, patriarchy, imperialism, and all the evils that afflict us now. Indeed, the second interpretation is the dominant hegemonic interpretation within the academy. I'm a weird guy to even write about these guys. If you go to graduate school now, if I send students to go to graduate school, and this has happened on several occasions, and they say, "I want to write about Jefferson." They say, "Are you crazy? You got to write about looms or the Connecticut dairy industry, 1781-82, tit by tit. You're not supposed to do this stuff." And I'm afraid most of the profession has abdicated the public, or is it, you know, they're writing to each other in a specialized language, and some of that's okay, but only for a while you're a graduate student, and maybe shortly thereafter, you ought to grow out of that. My point is there's a kind of juvenile attitude, adolescent attitude towards the founders. Like, it's a cartoon. And both images, the positive and the negative, are simply the different sides of the same revolving cartoon. We need to be mature. Now, this woman said that she's old enough now to have a kid that's 35. Is that correct? You got 150. I haven't gotten there yet. And that at some point our children should begin to see us maturely as the imperfect creatures that we are, who in most cases did the best we could. And I think that one of the distinguishing features of the last decade of work on the founders is that they're all flawed founders. We might be reaching that moment in terms of our own maturity, emotional maturity, to be able to see them and appreciate what they achieved while catching them in their own imperfection, which is what I try to do. Let me tell you, it's a kind of Oedipal pattern, isn't it? In some sense, you know? Freud knows what he's... You know, Shakespeare and Freud knew what they were talking about. That we need to break out of that. I'm going to tell you two stories, and actually three stories, and then I'll shut up and we'll have some back and forth. These are about Washington, which I'm supposed to talk about, right? It's the fall of 1776. Washington brings his Continental Army of about 12,000 troops down from Boston at the end of the Boston siege. The British have sailed away to defend New York City. A British army and navy of 32,000 has assembled on Staten Island. It's the largest amphibious force to have ever crossed the Atlantic, and it will be the largest until World War II to have ever crossed the Atlantic. 32,000 troops is bigger than the city of Philadelphia. Washington's got 12,000. They're riddled with smallpox. The average time of service of an American soldier in the Continental Army is 6 months. The average time of service of a British soldier and naval officer is 7 years. New York, because of the rivers and the coast, gives a huge advantage to anybody with naval supremacy, which the British have completely. Washington should have decided not to defend New York. He didn't do that. Why didn't he do that? Washington, at this stage of the war, thought of battle as a summons to duel. If the enemy presented himself to you, you were honor-bound to respond, or else be dishonorable. Now, that's a stupid male idea. Okay? The testosterone is flowing pretty high. The result is a disaster. Washington loses 9 of his 12,000 troops, wounded, killed, or deserters. It's total chaos. Washington flees across the river, across the Hudson, north of New York, around what is now the Tappan Zee Bridge, down into New Jersey and eventually into Pennsylvania. The first embedded journalist, Tom Paine, is with him and writes The Crisis, a collection of essays which begins, "These are the times that try men's souls." They certainly were. Washington had made a strategic blunder, and the war was in the balance. The revolution was in the balance. If General Howe, William Howe, had pursued Washington's army assiduously at that moment, the revolution would have ended. Washington would have been captured and hung as a traitor, and that would have been it, and history would have flowed off in a different direction. Howe doesn't do that. Why? There's this woman in New York called Mrs. Loring. She's married to a loyalist in New York. There is some question as to whether she herself was a loyalist or a kind of American spy. But Howe wants to spend the winter with Mrs. Loring, and that's what he does. So I believe that we should construct a monument to this woman somewhere in New York City, who gave her all. And it really made the difference between victory and defeat. what Washington had yet to understand, and it took him another 2 years to grasp it, and it eventually came to him at Valley Forge, which is a really interesting place, and it's all, you know, like the Courier and I have pictures of it, you know, make you think it must be mythological. It's not. There really was blood on the snow. They really were starving. 2,000 of 7,000 died. The states weren't providing supplies or blankets or huge loyalist pockets in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And the Quakers, of course, are sitting out the war altogether. What he comes to understand later is that his honor-bound definition of battle, he needs to overcome that. And he reaches an insight. Now, it's an insight that looks pretty straightforward and obvious in retrospect. But if you think about it, Robert E. Lee never had this. Napoleon never had it. Hannibal never had it. It was that he didn't have to win the war. The British had to win the war. He had to not lose. He was leading an army, but he was also leading, if you'll excuse the term, an insurgency. And eventually, if the British couldn't successfully destroy his army and destroy the insurgency, they would eventually decide to withdraw. The Americans didn't win the war. The British decided it wasn't worth it. And that's what happened. It took all his effort to come to that conclusion, though, because every ounce of his personal psyche was to engage the British on any occasion. He was looking for that on all. He kept thinking he would be able to take New York back, and it never happened. One thing that I learned in doing the research on this too, on this issue, that's really stuck with me: the people that won the war are the poorest and the most deprived of Americans at the time. And there's some residue of this for the Iraq war now for me, because the people over there are not the upper middle class Americans. It's wrong. They're the people that won the war that served what they call the duration. They didn't sign up for a one-year term. They signed up for the duration of the war. There's about 4,000 of them. They were indentured servants, they were ex-slaves, they were recent immigrants from Scotland and Ireland. They were fourth or fifth sons that had no inheritance. They had no other options. They're the reason we won the war. They didn't get paid. They never got a pension. They were promised all that, but they never got it. And their story has never been told. The myth of the militia has obscured their contribution. The notion that the militia won the war, that's nonsense. Washington never trusted the militia. The militia would run in any instance, in any battle. And the role of this, what he called the soldiery. And at the end of the war, just before he left to go back to Mount Vernon, he said, you know, when historians come to write the story of this, they will be accused of writing fiction. Because no one will ever believe that we have been able, as he said, to baffle the greatest military power on the planet with these soldiers. Steven Spielberg needs to discover this. And if you think about it, there's never been a great film about the Revolution. There's been a lot of films about the Civil War, World War I, World War II, but there's never been a great film about the Revolution. It's interesting why. Second story is about slavery. If you're writing a modern biography of Washington, you're not going to tell the story quite the same way they might have told it 30 years ago. And the profession has exposed the issue of race and slavery, as well as the Native American dilemma. And you're obliged as a historian to sort of deal with those issues on the front burner instead of the back burner. Washington began as a pretty typical Virginia planter who talked about his slaves as livestock. He didn't have any moral sense whatsoever. But as he became involved in the war and moved into the North and was exposed to other opinions, especially Quaker opinions, and then on his own staff, he had Hamilton and a guy called Richard Lawrence, who's from South Carolina, but was in favor of emancipation and sort of freeing all the slaves and enlisting them in the Continental Army. And Lafayette. He began to think of the issue differently. And by the end of the war, as he retired, he wrote four letters in which he said it was clear to him that the goals of the American Revolution were fundamentally incompatible with slavery, that it needed to end. It needed to end gradually. It needed to be put on the road to extinction. And he needed to do something about his own slaves. Now, his motives for doing something about his own slaves are mixed. They'd say there are 300 slaves at Mount Vernon. It's an interesting situation. He's losing money every year. Of the 300 slaves at any time, only 100 are working. The other 200 are too young, they're in child care, they're too old, they're in retirement, or they're too sick, they're in hospital. He's paying for them all. So his motives are not exclusively moral. They're partly economic. He believes it would be in Virginia's interest to abolish slavery and go to free labor. And imagine if Virginia had done that. I mean, the Civil War wouldn't have happened, I don't think, with Virginia and part of the Union. In addition, after the war, everything he does has something to do with his own sense of posterity's judgment. I mentioned this earlier. And there are a lot of Quakers that keep writing him and reminding him of this. So one of the reasons he makes a decision to free his own slaves in his will is because he knows if he doesn't do that, it's going to be a stain on his reputation. On the other hand, unlike Jefferson, Washington does not believe that Africans and African Americans are biologically inferior. Jefferson does believe that, writes that in Notes on Virginia. Washington believes they're victims of their own condition. And if freed, can develop in the same way that whites could. Jefferson doesn't think you can free the slaves and leave them in Virginia. They should be sent back to Africa. Washington says, free them and leave them right here. And there's a law in Virginia that says you can't do that. But ain't nobody going to oppose George Washington when he frees his slaves. And so he does that. Not only does he do that, but he creates an endowment for 25 years to support the progeny of the freed slaves and educate them and provide them with the basic tools to earn a living. He's the only prominent Virginia planter to do that. If you compare him against our own multicultural values, you're going to find him wanting. But if you compare him against his peers, he's remarkable in this regard. Final story. The greatest thing Washington did was to give up power. In Newburgh, after the war, he's got the army all trained. He doesn't think the war is over. He doesn't think Yorktown's the last battle. He gives a kind of domino theory of the British Empire. He says, Britain will never admit defeat. If they let us win this, they'll lose the Caribbean, and then lose Ireland, and then lose India. They'll never give up. And they've got a huge force here. They've got a force three times the size of the Continental Army still on the continent. By the way, a third of the British Army is Americans. But they do. And the treaty is concluded in 1783, and he's up in Newburgh. And he's got an army. It's the biggest. They're ready to fight. The Continental Army is better prepared to fight at the end of the war when they don't have to fight than ever before. They've got 15,000 people there. They haven't been paid in 2 years. They've been promised pensions, but the states are never going to deliver the goods. And the states are sovereign. And they know that. So there's a movement amongst the officer corps to march on Philadelphia, overturn the Continental Congress, and declare Washington emperor. Washington hears of this, and there was supposed to be a meeting of the officers to talk about this. He cancels the meeting. He says, you don't announce meetings. I announce meetings. And I now announce a new meeting, and we're going to meet. And he writes this speech, and he writes it in his own hand. And all kids ought to read this speech. All American high school kids ought to read this speech. It's really eloquent. And it basically says the values that we've been fighting for the last 7.5 years will be repudiated if you do this. He steps before them, and he's got a pair of glasses recently received from a doctor in Philadelphia, and he puts them on. They've never seen him wear glasses before. And he says, "Excuse me, gentlemen, but I have grown blind as well as gray in service to my country." They all start to cry. Now, he helps the tears because he sent his 12 aides out into the audience, like the Johnny Carson show, to make sure the response is correct. He's very theatrical in this regard. But there will be no American Caesar. There will be no American Cromwell. Or to put it in later terms, there will be no American Napoleon. There will be no American Stalin. There will be no American Mao. There will be no American Castro. The revolution is larger than any person. And he steps away. He goes down to Annapolis, where the Continental Congress is meeting temporarily, to surrender his sword. This is the Cincinnatus role. Swords into plowshares. And there's a big ball afterwards, and he dances every dance. He's a great dancer. And as a witness says, the ladies were lined up in rows to get a touch of him. At the end of the dance, it's like a John Ford movie. The horses are waiting at the door. He's gone. The greatest exit in American history. Over in England, George III, the king, is having his portrait painted by Benjamin West, an American artist. And West says to George III, "Your Excellency, Your Majesty, excuse me, there's word that Washington has rejected the crown." And George III says, "If he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world." He did, and he was. Final thought. A few years later, in 1784, as George III begins to lose his mental faculties, his first delusion, as reported in the London press, is that he was not George III. He was George Washington. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Linda Fairstein, Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 23rd, 2006.